thinking about being curious and generous, to understand, to believe generously that even if you think they're totally mistaken, even if you think that they're totally wrong, that they're doing what they see is right. And then curious to understand, how is it possible that somebody of goodwill could be doing that?
Hello, Our Voices Matter podcast audience. I am delighted to have with us today David Eisner, the president and CEO of Convergence. And full disclosure, I am on the board, and I've been on the board now for almost 2 years. And this is an organization that is near and dear to my heart because it is all about bringing us together. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Linda. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your service on the board.
Well, you know, when I first was introduced to Convergence and met Rob Fersh, whom you just succeeded, Rob is one of the founders, one of the co-founders of Convergence, I was immediately taken by the mission, which is to bring people together from divergent points of view on extremely important issues that are of critical national importance and trying to figure out how to bring folks together and identify solutions. What drew you to this work? Why did you join us at Convergence?
I've always focused a lot on community building, whether in the corporate sector where I worked for America Online and then Time Warner, or when I ran AmeriCorps, which an America's National Service, or focused on the National Constitution Center, or working on a service organization, Repair the World. I've always thought that we have the opportunity, as Harris Wofford, one of my mentors, used to say, we can split the atom of civic power. And that requires bringing our communities to work together across differences. There are so many ways of doing that. I worked a lot on bringing people together to serve in my career. But there's this big problem that as a result of polarization and as a result of people not being able to overcome their differences enough to even have dialogues about what solutions we need to bring to our toughest, most intractable issues. Because of that polarization, we're not solving our challenges. And I thought that I've never seen a better set of solutions than those that Convergence is working on. And so I'm delighted to be a part of the team now.
Well, you came in feet to the fire in the middle of a pandemic, and then shortly after there, massive protests on racial justice. What are your thoughts about leading the organization at this particular moment in history, and how Convergence can play a role in helping to resolve some of the issues that we're facing as a nation?
Well, I think, let me answer that perfect question, which is what we're all spending our time on. Let me answer that at three levels. At one level, this is just an indication that bringing people together to solve intractable issues has never been more important. What's happening with our healthcare crisis, the economic crisis, and this resurgence of our awareness and determination to do something about racial justice, all of these require people to come together. At another level, we at Convergence know that whether we're talking about healthcare or we're talking about education or we're talking about income and jobs, increasingly race is an element that has to be raised in those conversations. We're looking Absolutely. At disparate outcomes and deep flaws in the system in terms of how people of color are treated in the system and how they emerge from when the system engages with them. And so we're determined in all of our dialogues now, not just those that are explicitly about racial justice, to focus on those elements. And then finally, at the third level, we know that as an organization, and you know this, Linda, as a board member, that we have work to do. We can work on our own pipelines. We can work on our program selection, we can work on our contracting, we can work on our staff inclusion. There's a lot of work as an organization that we can do to better position ourselves to be part of a solution and to be able to bring our community with us. Convergence has a very strong, amazing, supportive community that cares deeply about solving intractable problems, and it's up to us to make sure that one of the intractable problems that the whole community focuses on is racial justice.
So before we talk about that specifically, I want to give people a little bit of a sense of how Convergence does its work.
Sure.
Maybe we could take one of the issues where we've brought people together and then have issued some sort of a paper or some recommendations. We've done a lot of work with Congress, you know, working with the bipartisan committee in Congress. So you want to just give a little bit of a snapshot so that people understand who we bring to the table, how we work, and then what the outcomes are.
Sure. So let me spend a little time talking about economic mobility, which about a year and a half ago, we issued a report called Working Up. And this resulted from 2 years of work by a group of stakeholders who were leaders in the corporate community, in the policy community, among labor unions, and among advocates for different communities that have been either vulnerable or badly impacted by challenges finding and keeping jobs.
And typically, these people would not be in a room together.
No. In fact, most of these people, when they come together, they're specifically coming together because they can't work with each other. So most of them start off being very suspicious that they're not going to be able to work with each other, a little bit defensive and guarded, that the other side may be there to take advantage of them. And the reason that the dialogue takes so long is most of the energy and effort goes into helping them understand each other's experiences and perspectives and figure out where they have common ground.
That's the trust building piece.
That is,
because you got to start there.
Yeah, you got to start with them being able to understand. And there's a moment when the penny drops, when everybody realizes that there's nobody at the table that doesn't really powerfully want to find a solution. Nobody at the table is there to take advantage of the other side. Nobody at the table is there to villainize or demonize. In fact, all of them think that the others are the ones doing the villainizing and demonizing.
Isn't that always the way it is? It's so crazy. We all want the same thing.
We all live in our bubbles, right?
Yeah.
We've cemented this pathway where people that used to be our opponents today are our enemies. And you know, the difference is really small, but it's the whole world in terms of ability to be. You're not generous with your enemies. You're not curious with your enemies. You're not trying to team up with your enemies, even though you might do that with opponents.
So once you've built the trust, the next step is.
The next step is beginning to look at the issue and figuring out where there's common ground to build on. So in the area of upward mobility, economic mobility and working up, it became clear that there was a set of policy ideas. Everybody agreed that government needed to be providing incentives for businesses to be creating pathways. There needed to be incentives around training workers with different kinds of skills. And there also needed to be solutions for workers to be able to stay in their jobs and not be distracted by the kinds of things that could be happening at home or with other parts of the workforce. And there was also a really big consensus that there's work that corporations can do to make to increase certain kinds of flexibility that made it a lot more likely that workers could keep their jobs, could perform well, and could find new jobs and also grow professionally. So
what was the final upshot and the ultimate paper that or report that was issued?
The upshot included recommendations in each of those areas around policy and around corporate practice and around future dialogues that had to happen around policy. And then afterwards, this was incorporated. So we're so pleased that organizations like Walmart actually embraced the recommendations and changed how they were working with their workers and how they were onboarding new employees.
Which is huge, you know, that sort of an outcome. So I think that gives people a little bit of an understanding of how convergence works. And it does take time. A big chunk of the time is done on the front end in determining who actually gets to come to the table. So let's move this conversation forward now to talk about where we are as a country, and specifically as it relates to racial justice. And I know that one of the things that we at Convergence are trying to do is to make sure that we have not only the right people at the table, but that the right people includes a diverse group. So I'm going to ask you to speak to that a little bit, what Convergence's response is to where we are as a nation and how we as an organization are looking at this issue and how we can help find some solutions.
So there's a couple of spaces here. The first piece is making sure that all of our tables include sufficient diversity. And that's actually a challenge for us because there's only a certain number of seats that any table can have in order for the dialogue to be deep and effective. And we've made a little bit of a practice of advantaging the advantaging people who bring power to be able to enact things, whether it's about pushing ideas into the corporate sector, pushing ideas into federal or state government, bringing ideas into public sector systems. And we realize that by advantaging people that have that influence, we're simultaneously supporting a status quo where people that don't bring that influence, we're repeating the cycle of them not
exactly voice. Exactly. Most of the people who have the power are white males.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
That, so, but on the other hand, we're not particularly useful if we only have dialogues that then end up with solutions that don't actually go into what's happening with government or what's happening in the states or what's happening in corporations. So finding that way to be to ensure that we bring sufficiently diverse voices and maintain our ability for the stakeholders to have influence in the real world in terms of what's happening with legislation and policy and corporate practice is an important thing to get both of them right. And one of the things that we're exploring now is the fact that a lot of diverse voices actually come from other kinds of non-traditional power centers. If you look at how Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party, for that matter, operate, they actually don't, they aren't traditional institutions, but they are very powerful. And so bringing people from some of those new power dynamics and perspectives into dialogues seems that that could be a really strong way for us to increase, especially racial diversity.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Completely agree with that. So talk a little bit about the current projects that Convergence is engaged in. And we have a couple of new ones that will be rolling out soon. So give people a sense of, you know, we can only work on so many at one time because it's very labor intensive to bring all these people together and to go through the process. So give a sense of kind of what we have on our plate and then what's coming.
Well, one of the really daunting and exciting challenges right now is, as you'd imagine, building trust for us has always been about bringing people physically together. And we're in this moment.
Yeah, physically together. Physically, right? Yeah. I know.
And so, figuring out the right way to use the digital environment to not just to negotiate, not just to mediate, and not just to hear each other's perspectives, but to actually build trust, the kind of stuff that often happens over coffee. That's a hard thing to do. So we took a little pause, and now we're near getting ready to launch a couple of really powerful dialogues. One of them, I mentioned to you the economic mobility piece. And as you know, Linda, we're turning that into a reconstituted dialogue. We're bringing the folks together who have already built trust, already have relationships and know how to work together and solve problems together. They're coming together to focus on economic recovery for America's workers. We know that there couldn't be a more important challenge, and we can't afford to just watch the two parties throw solutions at each other that the other party won't accept. We did that in the Great Recession that started in 2008. And as a result, we had many, many millions of people exit the workforce, which led directly to things like the opioid epidemic and even contributed to some of the grassroots anger in the middle of the country that we see playing such an important role today in our politics. So we think that this economic recovery for America's workers can get some fast work done. And we're excited to be, this time it looks like we'll have, in addition to the policy side of the table and advocates for vulnerable communities and advocates for workers, we're going to have a lot of powerful corporate players who are actually in a position to do a lot of this hiring and who are able to set standards for how the industry moves. The other one is, you know, Linda, that's really exciting is we're going to have a dialogue on guns. Now, before I think that before the pandemic hit, we would have thought that bringing stakeholders together and really a diverse set of stakeholders, people who advocate very forcefully and strongly on the interests of gun owners and gun rights, as well as advocates who've been forcefully advocating for limiting gun violence and for different kinds of management of gun ownership. We're bringing them together with experts and leaders that all sides trust. And we're beginning to hone in on this area about the kind of misuse of guns that can happen in homes. We know that 2/3 of gun deaths come from suicides. We also know that the most likely a new gun owner is the most likely gun owner to commit suicide with a firearm, And we know that the largest, or one of the largest growing demographics of new gun owners is African Americans. And so there's a real opportunity here to make an important difference. And I think all by itself, thinking about how we can significantly reduce the number of gun deaths in this country through the misuse of firearms in homes would be a huge step forward. But if we can also use this as an opportunity for building relationships and connections and a little bit of trust between these sides and have everybody understand that the other side is not out to defeat them, but rather to pursue their own interests, we may be able to make progress on a whole bunch of other fronts in the guns related area.
Well, I'm really excited about both of these new projects that we're undertaking, and a lot of time and thought went into deciding on these issues. And, you know, people bring us issues all the time and say, you know, tackle this, tackle that. And I mean, there's so many intractable issues that we're facing as a nation right now, and guns is certainly one of them. And, you know, people can get dug in on one side, but this dialogue is not about gun rights. It's not about that. It's about the as you were articulating, the misuse of firearms. And I, you know, I don't think people realize or know that 2/3 of gun deaths are suicide.
Right.
Which is huge.
It's huge. And actually it does. And both understanding rights and understanding responsibilities and finding ways for both things to be strong and present conversations and the discussion of gun ownership is a really important step to take.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, so many companies are stepping up to help their communities through this challenging time. And here in Texas, one of those companies is HEB. The grocery giant has shown time and again that it knows how to handle a crisis, which is why it was ready to jump into action when the scope of the COVID-19 pandemic became apparent. The company's efforts and expertise were highlighted in a recent Texas Monthly article, quoting here, San Antonio-based HEB has been a steady presence amid the crisis. The company began limiting the amounts of certain products customers were able to purchase in early March, extended its sick leave policy, and implemented social distancing measures quickly, limited its hours to keep up with the needs of its stockers, added a coronavirus hotline for employees in need of assistance or information, and gave employees a temporary increase in mid-March. I've shopped at HEB from the moment they came to Houston almost 20 years ago. I'm proud to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. Thank you, HEB. So, what can people today, folks who are watching and listening to this, who are engaged in really courageous conversations right now about race and inequality and police brutality and so many other things related to our cultural fabric, what can you offer them as ways to converse with each other based upon what convergence has been able to bring to the table successfully? What are the lessons learned from the convergence method that people can use right now in their everyday lives as they are talking to people who are opposite of to them? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we see opposites in so many, along so many different continua. There are people that have opposite ideologies. There are people in opposite or opposing parties. There's people who have identities that where the identities feel in opposition to each other. And it's the most important thing that we're learning is it's a very, very small minority of people that bring ill will or that are trying to do something nefarious or trying to do something mean or cruel. And so I encourage folks when they're making sweeping statements about groups of people. So, for example, and I think the best way to think about this right now is in the context of the presidential election. There's a lot of ways that you could imagine casting aspersions on a candidate, on the sitting president, on Vice President Biden. But be really careful before you cast aspersions about everybody that's voting for them. I hear all the time say, you know, anyone that's supporting President Trump is a blank. And you can fill in that blank. Or anybody that's going to be supporting Biden is a blank. And that's wrong. In general, there's a real diversity of folks out there. And there may be extremes on all sides, but the vast majority of people are people that truly have a different perspective, an opposing perspective. And thinking about being curious and generous to understand, to believe generously that even if you think they're totally mistaken, even if you think that they're totally wrong, that they're doing what they see is right. And then curious to understand, how is it possible that somebody of goodwill could be doing that? And then try to understand it. I think generosity and curiosity, from what we see at Convergence, are the changes that happen to enable the dialogue to become a trusting one.
I love that. That's such a beautiful way to put it. Generosity and curiosity. And if you come at it from that perspective, as opposed to, I know what you're all about,
right,
before you even give that person a chance to, you know, say whatever it is their perspective might be, you've already made up your mind if you come at it from that perspective. However, if you're going to give them the benefit of the doubt and be generous, and assume that they're a good person, just like you are, with an opposing point of view, and then be curious enough to ask the questions and then listen to the answer.
Right. That's exactly right. Linda, what do you interview and talk to people who are really different all the time. Do you have is there something, first of all, from Convergence that you use or leverage, or are there other lessons that you use to be able to relate to people that really
are
wrong things you think?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So for me, I think like a journalist. I mean, it's in my DNA at this point, my journalistic training, which taught me that when I'm interviewing someone or I'm doing a story, it's not my job to insert my opinion. My job is to ask the questions and get both points of view, present the information, and then let the audience make up its mind about how they feel. So it's not about me. It's about being able to pull out the information that is required on both sides without my judgment, in order to allow that information to be presented in as less of a biased manner as possible, understanding that we all have our own biases. We can't be human. You know, it's part of a human trait. We all have our biases. The challenge is to not let that come into play when you're trying to deliver information. And, you know, so we're having this conversation now. It's, you know, we could have a whole conversation just about media and its role in this entire scenario. That's several shows. But to answer your specific question about how I handle it when I'm interviewing people, I try to stay neutral. You know, I try to be an open slate and come at it with curiosity. With curiosity, genuinely wanting to know what the other person is thinking, feeling, wants to convey, and I try to do it with respect for everyone, regardless of what the point of view is. So that's how I come at it, from a position of neutrality and wanting to maintain that, because if I'm going to be a trusted source of information for the people who are listening to and watching my podcast or anything else that I'm going to publish, I want them to trust that I'm not just trying to convey one point of view. I'm a journalist, and I'm approaching everything that I do online on my platforms from that perspective. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't times when I will give my opinion, but when I do that, it's very clear, this is my opinion. But I try to be respectful of all points of view, and that's how I come at it.
And I'm sure that that's one of the reasons that people feel safe coming, speaking with you, because of your reputation and their knowledge that regardless of what you think personally, you're going to be giving them a fair venue for them to air what they're thinking. And as you know, this is really one of the biggest challenges for Convergence, is that we have to maintain that neutrality and that balance in a really deep way, or we won't be a safe, fair venue. So for example, we don't have a position on guns. We don't have a position on economic mobility or on healthcare. It was you'll recall, Linda, for our last board meeting, it was quite an interesting discussion about how we express our values around racial justice without, as a venue, losing the ability to bring people together. Because one of the more important pieces of this work is to help people find ways to come together around it. And it would be very easy to express an opinion that would make us maybe feel good, but would actually make it really hard for us to do the hard work we've got in front of us.
Exactly. It's a delicate balance. And Convergence's approach to solving these issues and bringing people together is what attracted me to the organization in the first place. And I think there's never been a more critical moment in history for an organization like Convergence to do its work. And so I think that we have to be very mindful and careful of how we move forward, as you say, to make sure that we're not alienating any side, because our job as conveners is to find a way to bring us together. And that's the critical piece. So for people out there watching, listening today, what can they do if they would like to be engaged and involved with Convergence's work in some way?
Well, we'd be so delighted if you would come to convergencepolicy.org. That's convergencepolicy.org, and sign up to get information, take a look at some of the projects that are underway, look at some of the people that are participating with us, and we would love to have you as part of our community. We have events all the time. We have opportunities to come together in groups big and small. Sometimes just about how people come together, and sometimes about some of the issues we're wrestling with. We'd love for more people to join us. And I just want to note one additional thing. You know, we're in this moment where this is happening in a huge wave. You mentioned the media, and sometimes the media makes it look like this dysfunctional polarization is continuing even through the pandemic. But when you look at the numbers in the polls, we have 80% plus of both Republicans and Democrats saying that this is a moment for all of us to be working hard to protect the vulnerable among us, whether we're talking about in the pandemic sense, where over 80% of both parties think we should be staying at home, sheltering in place to protect our vulnerable elders or people with underlying diseases, or that's racial justice, where we're seeing huge majorities of people changing their minds in just a few years, changing their minds from believing that there was no systemic racism, that there was no institutional racism, to today, huge majorities understanding that systemic racism, institutional racism, is core inside our country and that we need to eradicate it. So my hope is that we can come out of this moment with as many ways as possible of keeping that feeling of all being in it together, which is the best starting point for being able to come together.
What a perfect way to wrap up our conversation. That is my hope as well. And I have to say that we're really fortunate to have you leading us at Convergence. You, just in the 2 months that you've been with us and having to get up to speed so quickly and in the middle of all of the chaos that is surrounding us, I know that our organization's in good hands, and I'm really excited to see how we're going to move forward and continue to address these issues and bring hopefully the rest of the country along with us, with all of the other great organizations and great work that's being done on a grassroots level, because it really is going to take all of us to get through this together.
It will. And Linda, since you're my board member, I'm marking that down as a very high-level performance review for myself. Thank you.
Okay. Duly noted. Duly noted. Thank you so much, David Eisner. Really appreciate your thoughts and your perspective today. And I want to thank our audience for joining us and for giving David permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. And we will see you next time.